Hello and welcome to another episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have one that I personally shoved into the schedule desperately because I was so keen to do it. And that is ADHD and sensory overwhelm, identifying triggers and finding relief. Welcome to you, Rebecca Torpy.
Thank you for having me.
And Rebecca Torpy is a OT. She is a mum of two girls who are 5 and 7, so they're quite young. Rebecca also has ADHD. Did you want to talk about how you wrote me that email, Rebecca?
It was in the school holidays and I was having one of those days that we all have as ADHD mums or just as mums in general where their kids are refusing to go to their holiday program and I was basically just putting off calling the clients to cancel them and distracting myself. I've been thinking about sending you an email for so long and I was like, I'm just going to do it. And I just wanted to highlight the importance that I feel we need to place on understanding our sensory preferences and understanding what sensory processing is, because it's such a huge part of our challenges for parenting in general, but challenges if you are neurodivergent, because the way you are perceiving sensory input is really challenging. Just thinking about school holidays and everything that's going on, it's the noise, you're out of your normal routines. I just ended up emailing you saying, hey, this is something I really care about. Have you ever thought about having someone? It doesn't need to be me, but I really feel like it would be valuable for you to share it with your listeners.
It was such an interesting, because I do get a lot of emails these days. I always try and prioritize people that actively listen. I wrote back straight away and I was like, I don't know when we're going to fit this in, but we're going to fit this in, because I had found in my, I hate using the word journey, but look, it is a bit of a journey. There's no real word for it. With ADHD meds that I was left with some just significant sensory issues, but I didn't know what to do about it. I think that we all talk about sensory overload a lot, but yet do we really know what it is? And do we really know the strategies of how to, I suppose, deal with it, which is why I was so keen for Rebecca to come on. So if we jump right in, what exactly is sensory overload?
So sensory overload is essentially a response when we have too much information coming into one or many of our senses. And it essentially overwhelms our brain's ability to process or make sense of the information. And then that can send us into sort of a fight or a flight response or a shutdown. But to really understand sensory overload, I think you actually need to understand what sensory processing is and think about what all of our senses are. And as OTs, we often focus a lot on sensory processing and understanding our unique sensory profile. So there's often an assessment that we do called a sensory profile. There's also one called a sensory processing measure. It's really getting an idea about how you respond in everyday life to different information. So it looks at your 5 external senses, our smell, our taste, our touch, what we can hear, what we can see, and how we respond to that, but also our internal sensory systems, which is a vestibular system. So that's being able to get the information. We actually get it from receptors in our inner ear and it's in response to gravity. So that's our movement response. We know whether we're up or down or moving or still. And then our proprioception, that's our body sense. So we get that from our muscles and joints and we know whether, you know, tells us about where our body position is. And then we've got our 8th sense, which is more of a new kind of concept, which is that interoception. So what's going on inside my body and how can I respond to that? A really good way to think about sensory overload, and I guess just our sensory tolerance, is if you think about when you're sick, everything is more annoying, right? You've just got less tolerance to anybody because you're feeling rubbish. The noises are louder or people touching you are more annoying. So we're heightened already because we're uncomfortable. So other things are harder to process. If we even go back a step and we think about in terms of our sensory systems, and I know you've spoken to other people about sensory overload in terms of how we all have different levels of what we can process. So we've all got different thresholds to sensory input. So some kids and adults can have really high thresholds for tactile input. So they love being touched. They want to touch things all the time. And they're those kids that always need to have something in their hand. However, they might not like light touch. So they might not like other people touching them. And information coming in is going to be different to us taking in our own information. In the same way that we might be really sensitive to noise, but often those same children are the ones making the noise. And I don't know whether you've got any of those in your household, but
I have got three of them. It's interesting you say that because they are so noisy, but yet they don't like each other making noise. So one of them will walk around singing, but then be angry with the other one for talking or for having the TV on. But like they're the noisiest kid there. So yeah, it's interesting. They seem to make a lot of noise, but yet can't deal with it.
Yeah. And it's, I guess if we think about all of our sensory systems, some people talk about the cup kind of concept, and you can tolerate so much input going into your cup before it overflows. And that's when you're in sensory overload. I also like to think of it like a mixer when you have all of the different volume controls. So a little bit is going to feel like a lot of input, or a lot might feel like a little, like your mixer's turned down. So you need a lot of input to register. What we sometimes see is that if we are sensitive to the input coming in, one way we can control our environment is by overriding that with our own sound. So I don't like the sound around me. So if I'm making a sound, I can make it predictable. I know what it is, and I can hear that instead of hearing something else. So it's an adaptive strategy.
That's really interesting. I turn up the music in the car just to avoid like screeching and sudden sounds, and then the kid talking constantly. And I'm like, let's all listen to this song. And then if they keep talking, depending on my mood, I keep turning it up thinking, oh my God, at some point, will they just stop and listen to the music?
And what's really challenging with neurodivergent families is that they're not just one neurodivergent person, and no one person will have the same sensory profile. So even your sensory seekers will all be seeking slightly different versions of the same input. But I think understanding each person in the house as their sensory profile is really important because they don't often match up.
I thought it was really interesting that you talked about different sensory profiles, because my five-year-old, Billy, all he wants to do is to touch. So he's sensory seeking. Yeah. He walked past, and I want to use the word hit, but it's not actually malicious hitting. Mm-hmm. It's just give me some attention. I'm here. Mm-hmm. He's just constantly on you. When I wake up in the morning, he's just on me. Like he's on me the entire time. And it's exhausting and draining the amount of sensory input that he needs. And if you don't give it to him, he escalates and escalates. Mm-hmm. When actually my whole body, get this kid away from me. Like I've been touching you for about 6 hours right now. And then I'll sit down on the couch and then he's on me like a blanket.
And I think listening to that, it sounds like he's got a really high threshold for touch input and you have a much lower threshold. And touch is a tricky one because there's that light touch. So that light tickly touch is often quite alerting and arousing, where that deep pressure can sometimes be quite calming. So a lot of the time we need that. We just don't realize that we need that. So you're talking about Billy wanting to touch everything. So he has a high threshold for touch. He wants a lot and he's seeking that. So he's having an active response. So if we've got a high threshold, we'll either go out and actively seek it, or we will just maybe not notice what's going around because you need a lot, but you're not getting it. So you just sit around and you're like, I don't notice anything because nobody's touching me and I'm not getting the right input. So sometimes they're those kids that maybe look like they're a little bit spaced out and they can't really engage because they're not getting enough of that input in to meet their needs so that they're in that sort of right state for learning and for engagement. And then we've got our avoiders. So again, an avoiding is another example of an active response. So if you don't like it and you actively avoid it, and that might be that you go somewhere else, that you make up an excuse to get out of it if you've got the language to, or for kids that don't, that hit. I'll often see kids that have really high sensitivity to sound from other kids, and that hurts them and they need to get out of that environment, so they'll hit someone. And it's not that they're necessarily naughty or that they're thinking, they're able to even think through to that consequence, but they need to get out of there because they are so overloaded and that's the only adaptive response that they've got. So of course we're going to teach them what else they can do and look at strategies, but in that moment they're using what I guess their best adaptive response, which is to do an action that gets them out of there.
So you mean, for example, I know that if I hit somebody here, I will get to leave this classroom. Mm-hmm. I know I will get to go to the principal's office or whatever it is. And I know I get to go for a walk, I get to get off the mat, and something else is going to happen, and that's better than being here. That so makes sense.
Or if I say a swear word, or if I push a kid, or if I say, and kids are so clever, they work out really quickly what works. If you think about in a daycare setting, for example, a kid comes up, they get too close, you push them away, the first thing is teachers jump in and they remove them. And it's not that a kid that's going around purposely hitting people. These kids are naughty. They just haven't learnt what they need, and they don't have necessarily have the language. And we often as adults don't have that either, because we don't have that sensory lens to think about what's happening beforehand as well.
That's so interesting. My husband and I had a really heavy conversation because he was talking about Billy hitting him. And when I'm saying hitting, like, he probably hits me lightly to get attention. Like, it's like a pretty hard poke, but he definitely is a bit more aggressive and tactile with my husband. Mm-hmm. My hubby was more on the approach of hitting is not okay, and it would often be at inconvenient times. He's just gotten home, or he just wants to sit down for a second, or they've already done something together, and then Billy just wants it to be more and more. And there's this constant like pushing and hitting, and it's, again, it's not malicious, but it's annoying more than anything else. And even though he's told no, as you said, he's learnt that something will happen, whether it's negative or my hubby will get up and crack it, or he'll eventually maybe say, okay, fine, I'll do it for another 10 minutes. Something happens eventually.
If he's got a really high threshold for that deep pressure, for that crash and bash, if he's a goer, he wants lots of movement. Again, he needs a lot to even notice it. And sometimes we find that those kids are also the kids, so that's your proprioceptive system in play. If they need a lot, they may not be really tuning in to how much force they're actually using. So they might be the kids that push too hard on things, that slam the doors, they're mum, but they're actually hitting you, and they don't know that's hurting you, because that is just their speed. They're fast, they push, they don't actually get that feedback about where their body is in space, and they need more. So you need to feed the need, but it's also about to keep your sanity, finding the time so that it's going to work.
Fucking tricky.
They're so tricky. And I think as parents, where it gets really challenging is, especially when you've got your own needs and your own demands and we're just so busy, it's being able to, even for ourselves, have that level of executive functioning of going, if I meet this need, then his need is met, and then I can do the thing that I need to do. So yeah. For example, if you're at home with your three children and your husband comes home and he just wants to talk to you first, and he wants to tell them, first I'm going to talk to mum and then we're going to play, that's just so hard for them to understand.
Yeah.
And you're trying to get them to understand his need in that moment is talking to you and offloading his day. And you're probably trying to think about what's next and think about the kids that are yelling, and you just want them to stop because they've been yelling for the last hour and you just really need something to happen. If you think about flipping that, do you come home and you get straight into a, let's have a big wrestle and a big cuddle and I'm going to tip you upside down and I'm going to give you a tickle and I'm going to give you a squash and that's what you need. And then he's seen, he's not constantly interrupting you. He's filled that sensory, I won't even say cup. These kids have buckets. Like, they just need so much of that input in. Then he's going to be a lot more receptive to understanding that, okay, now mum and I need to talk. So what are you going to choose now?
That's a really good way of putting it. I think we've probably all got a partner that wants to talk to you first because they have something that has happened that day, let's say, and then the children are left. Let me talk for 5 to 10 minutes and then I'll play with you, which is very difficult for them to wait. What happens in my house is that my hubby will start talking to me and the kid can't wait because they're excited, but he has got something he wants to say, right? So he will want to continue the conversation. But what actually happens for me on my end is I'm like, okay, cool. So now we're interrupted every 3 to 4 words. The conversation that would have taken 5 minutes is now taking 15. Nobody is getting their needs met. I'm completely in the middle and I don't have a clear thought pattern. My husband, he just keeps saying relentlessly, what do you think? What do you think? I don't know what I think because I can't think about what you're saying because I'm dealing with three people that are now really amped up needing attention. And I can so see your point, because I think one of the overloads for mums is that never completed conversation. It's constantly interrupted. I said to my husband before, I'm really fucking done with being interrupted, because I actually had a friend here to look after my kids so I could just do one thing, right? And then the handyman, who said he was just going to have a look, decided that he would actually do the job. So what that meant is the electricity was going on and off. So the screen that I like to use to edit was going on and off, which was really annoying. And then he was coming in, giving me constant updates on whether he could fix the light or not, which I didn't give a shit about. And then the kids came in and out because they didn't want me to leave. And I was like, oh my God. And then my husband came home and decided to tell me about his day. And I was like, Oh my God, I just don't think I've actually been able to have something uninterrupted in weeks. Do you know what I mean? It drives me mad.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as mums, the challenge is that we're always holding on so many different things about what we need to do. So we've got our work jobs, we've got our home jobs, and the mental load is so big. And then if you've got kids with additional needs where you have to do a lot of that scaffolding, you have to be building in whether it's time in their day for their sort of time to just decompress, a lot more of that preparation about, so we're going here and I need to tell you all the steps and I've got to talk you through that and we've got to talk about what that might be, or we're going to this birthday party and it's going to be noisy, so I've got the headphones in my bag, but then we're ADHD mums, so we didn't bring the headphones with us, so we've got to think of another thing that we can use instead. It's just so many things that you're constantly thinking about. If you're the primary carer, there's often that I have to stop what I'm doing for somebody else. Sometimes I don't get to stay awake to finish my notes because I need to get the kids, because if I don't get them before 5:30, they're going to be crazy. And that means it's 9 o'clock and it would have been much easier to finish it at 5, but it's not where our life is right now. And I'm okay with that, but it doesn't mean it's easy.
I think only mums maybe of kids with additional needs really get the intensity of it. I think last night, for the millionth time, the kids had broken a key off the back door. And I usually don't prioritize stuff like that because I just don't want to deal with a locksmith on top of everything else. Last night, I think hubby was saying to me, oh, so where should we put the spare keys for the back door? And we'd had a really awful day. We had sick kids on and off all week and a lot of stress at work. He kept asking me, where should we put the keys? And I said to him, I just don't really care. I don't care where we put the keys. I don't care. And he's very specific about where he likes things. I literally don't care. But he continues to ask. Eventually, like 9 o'clock, I put all the kids to bed and I went to lock the back door. And as I go to lock the back door, I thought, I won't put the key there because he's going to say, don't do that. As I went to put the key down, he goes, is that where you're going to put the key? And I just blew up. Like I just lost my temper because I was like, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going to put the key. It doesn't matter where I put the key. And I just really lost my temper, which isn't like me. And then he was very offended and I was like, I had to say sorry. I didn't want to do the whole sorry, but I think that's really a cop out when you go sorry, but you were really annoying. Sorry, so I'll be yelling at you, but you really suck. So you deserved it. I was trying to do a proper apology because he didn't deserve me as my temper. But I suppose in his mind, it was one question. In my mind, it was the 750,000th question that day of something that didn't matter. And I just wanted to go to bed and be left alone.
It's often the straw that breaks the camel's back. And it's whether it's questioning constantly or whether it's sounds all the time or whether it's the feel of something, uncomfortable undies all day. And then you're just so sick of feeling icky and someone says something and you've lost it. It just is that one thing that you cannot handle because you are at your boiling point.
Yeah, and you can't offload. Look, we all try not to offload to our kids. So sometimes my husband gets in the firing line because
absolutely.
You can't.
He's a safe person.
Yeah, and you can't. If someone says, can I have a drink or can I do this? I really try and hold in a rage, which is probably cancer causing, but I try and hold it in. And then when the kids are in bed and my husband asks me a question that just seems doesn't need to be asked and I have to turn my mind back on, It's just, can you not? I just don't care. I feel bad about when I say that, but I think we just also got to just quickly touch on the elephant in the room that I think is going to be there is the whole thing around having sex at the end of the day, because it's really difficult for me to communicate with my husband, who I love dearly, by the way. Like I'm in a loving relationship and yes, we have three kids, but most people I think would have an expectation that they would still be having some sort of sex life. But it's difficult for him to comprehend a lot of the time that I'm just like touched out. I just want to be left alone. But then in fairness, on his perspective, I'm like thinking he probably feels unloved at this point because I don't want to sit down and watch TV with him. I don't really want to talk to anybody else. And then he is probably, in fairness, last night trying to start a conversation with me because I just was like really done. And then I suppose it's like that lack of then having time or any energy left.
When you talk about being touched out, so you've had all these little moments building up across the day of these little bits of touch, of people always wanting to be on your body, whether that's kids sitting on you or just feeling like everybody's in your space and just wanting some space. And it sounds like there's not a lot of time to, I keep saying decompress, it's probably the best way to describe it. you think about almost like a volcano, if every little thing you're getting up and up and up, then you're just going to explode. Like you need an opportunity to come back down so that you're back within your window of tolerance. One way that people will often talk about sensory, but also around just general input, is around that window of tolerance. We can be high energy, low energy, and somewhere in between. And if we think about when we're in our window of tolerance, we can cope, we can have, you know, good conversations, we can have meaningful interactions, we can actually access the cognitive part of our brain, our thinking brain. We're not in that fight or flight or explode or freeze or shut down or pull away mode. When we get too high, we're in that fight or flight, get away from me mode. When we're too low, we just want to lay down and do nothing. We've got no energy, or completely withdraw. What happens is across the day, we're going to go up and down and closer to our thresholds. If there's sensory challenges, generally our band of tolerance is narrower. So it's a lot harder to stay within that. And it means that we need more breaks throughout the day. So what's happening, if you're feeling like you're really touched out, you've had too much tactile input, it's about getting that balance across all of the senses and working out what is harming for you and working out what is alerting for you and working out what things will make you feel calm and organized and what things will irritate you, essentially. If that light touch is really overwhelming and you've just had too much of it for the day, do you actually need to get away from everybody? Do you need to just say, go for a run where you're really using your muscles? There's that huff and puff. You're really activating that system that helps to bring everything back down and re-regulate all of those sensory systems. And it almost resets them in a way, so that then when that extra touch input comes in, so whether that's the last kisses and cuddles from the kids before they go to bed, or whether that's wanting to have sex with you later, you're back in your own body, you're feeling calm, you're feeling like you can process that without going into that fight or flight or just freeze and withdraw and I don't want to do that mode.
I think it's that, like you were talking about the cup, like it's so constant that I feel like it never empties. So then I never give like quality touch, or like the input then I think is less because I never have an empty cup. If I actually had more availability, I would be able to do some of those things, maybe meet those needs.
I know you were talking about not even knowing what you needed. If you had a break, was going to the shop,
totally.
It's too noisy, going, I don't know what to do to then get that reset. How do I stop all of that input coming in? I don't know what to do. So that is when I think looking at your own sensory profile and looking at what, if you think about touch, what kind of touch do I like? What kind of touch don't I like? If the kids have to be on me, do I prefer them to literally be laying on me where I'm squashed underneath them and that is fine? Or do I want them to brush my hair? Or are you just like, oh my God, the feeling of that just makes me want to vomit. So it's working out what you like and what's regulating for you, and then finding your Venn diagram. Are you thinking about what do you like and what do your kids need? You've got three, so you know, you have to have a really complicated one. And where do they all cross over? Because that's what you want to be doing. That's what you want to have more of that in your day, because that's going to be regulating for everybody.
It's been a tricky one because there's not a lot of time at the moment. And I think moving my daughter towards homeschooling has only reduced any chance of any semblance of being alone ever, which has upped it again of intensity. And I've still got a 5-year-old who's repeating kindy. He's often here with me as well. So it's pretty nightmarish, actually, if you think about sensory overload. And Billy also has quite bad separation anxiety. So he will say to me, if I try and leave, I feel like I might die when you leave. It's like I'm his food source, loving source. Like no one else is good enough. It has to be me. So leaving is difficult. And my hubby tries his best where he will try and carve out like, oh, here's an hour. Go and do something for yourself. And I think that's his way of attempting to help. What will I do with that hour? I don't want to make this depressing, but sometimes I just think, oh, is that all there is? Is this it? Is that my me time? Like, holy shit. Like, I know it's not going to last forever, but the days feel long.
Yep. And they really would, because if you're not getting that opportunity to reset, then you're going back. I guess if you think about you're halfway up that threshold where you're going to explode and you only get to come a quarter of the way back down. It sounds like for you and for your particular sensory sort of processing in your sensory profile, it's like noise is something that's...
Yeah, noise is one of the problems. I think the screens are part of the problem and the TV blaring. And then, of course, the kids have ADHD. So if there's background noise, they will turn the volume up. Then they'll compete with the volume and it will go up and up. And I just feel like all I do is just yell like my dad used to yell, turn it down. Even my headphones here that I'm wearing, you can't really wear them all the time because then often there's a fight. You can't hear the fight. So then I'm like, it's not really safe to walk around or sociable. Like it's a bit much. This is its tricky thing. So then I put the headphones on the kids and I say, okay,
yeah,
headphones, right? But then I just feel like, what a terrible mother am I that I'm making my kid put on headphones, right? And then I get in my head about the guilt.
I think you need to be able to just give yourself a rest and give yourself a break, because you're not going to be able to keep co-regulating your kids if you're not regulated yourself. Sensory input that isn't the input that we need will dysregulate you. As a parent, so much of your job is about co-regulating your kids and being able to be the calm while they're having their big emotions. And so if they're on devices anyway, if they're watching TV, that's what they're doing. If you could just go, you know what, that's what you're doing. We're going to do that for an hour. Put your headphones on. You're not all bouncing off each other and the volume's going up and that's overloading you. If that means that at the end of that hour, everyone's happy with their screen time, nobody's saying, but I didn't get to choose, or I couldn't hear mine and that's not fair and they interrupted me. That wasn't actually a break for anybody, was it?
That's a good point, actually. This sounds really awful. Lucky my hubby doesn't listen to this podcast, but he goes out and does rugby coaching at nighttime. And initially I was a bit like, oh, now he works at night as well. And oh, like that's me by myself again with kids. Anyway, I actually look forward to the nights. It sounds awful, but I've put headphones on. They each watch what they want to watch. And then sometimes I sit down and watch something myself, or I'll just sit and on my bed and eat dinner, which sounds awful, but it's just a quiet room. And I actually feel a little bit better. Whereas if he's home, he's really lovely. He wants to talk to me all the time. It sounds like I'm such a whinger. But like he wants to have these lovely chats. And sometimes I'm just like, oh my God, someone else get to talk to me. So 2 nights a week, I actually quite look forward to him not being there so I can be alone by myself reading a book. Sounds terrible.
Doesn't sound terrible. It sounds like you know what is actually going to help you with your own regulation. So something to focus on visually, a way to have a little bit of an escape, being able to just be in, you know, your own company without that extra noise, just to reset. And do you find that then on those nights when you're then doing the bed routine, are you feeling more calm, ready?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, because you've recalibrated, you're back down into a space where you can take on more information and more auditory input, having that time where everything is just dulled down for a little bit so that you can feel like you're actually re-regulated. That makes a huge difference. I think if we go back to how that lines up with sensory overload, it's the questions, it's the noise, but it's also the thinking. It's that constant
always having to have an answer.
And when you're the person who's doing more of that caregiving, they want a real answer, not a I don't know or a just because. They want an actual answer. So then you're also having to think. So you've got the cognitive load, as well as not only is this just adding to the noise, but then it's also going to be harder if one child is asking you a question and expecting an answer, but then two other children are in the background yelling or screaming or playing a game or turning a music up, but the other child wants a question and they want you to be able to focus on them. That's so hard because you just can't dampen that sound behind you. Is that something that you experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. It's all the half thoughts. So, for example, earlier today, because we're having some issues with something at work, my hubby was like, okay, so what was the time frame around this decision that you made? When did that happen? What month? And he starts asking me questions, right? At the same time, one is saying, my throat hurts, I need more medicine. And the other one's going, why isn't my laptop working? I want to log on to IXL. And then it's the TV's in the background. And then it's like this constant that I have to go do half of one job, come back. He's still waiting for an answer. I'm still trying to think of a thought pattern. And then something else happens. And I'm like, I actually haven't had a clear thought where I can actually think of something I actually need to shut my brain off. And it's not even my own ADHD.
It sounds like it's not being able to filter out that information. And part of that is because you're a mum and you're their primary caregiver. I think there's an extra layer of sensory processing going on as being a mum, because you do have to tune in to those things. Because how our senses work is we've got our sort of protective senses that we want to know, is this safe or is this unsafe? If it is safe, then what do we need to get from this? Is that background conversation relevant to me? No, I don't need to tune into that. But when it's our children, we've got three that we do always have to be tuning into. I don't have three, you've got three. And they all tend to talk at the same time. And the more that we can know, I think in terms of sensory processing and sensory overwhelm, knowledge is absolutely power. The more you know about your sensory needs and the more you know about the sensory needs of everybody in your house, the better you can be equipped for it. So if you know that I am really overloaded by your questions right now because there's too much going on, and the more you practice saying that and letting your husband know and teaching him that's really challenging for you, the more you can set your environment up and you can set your routines up to support your sensory needs. We really need to talk about this. I just need to sort the kids out, or you need to help me sort the kids out. So then we're going to go into the room and talk and have this for 5 minutes. We actually need to do this without interruption, because I'm going to have to look this up, or I'm going to have to remember, and I can't do this right now. So being able to go, I can only focus on this level of information if I don't have all this noise in the background.
There's a common element when you have a neurodivergent family. I've definitely heard of mums that feel the same, that you have a partner that requires maybe confirmation that they're doing the right thing and they're actually like helpful, but they're just requiring like prompting, confirming that they're doing the right thing. But I think it's when they get a bit bigger and they all have complex questions. And I think that's when the fatigues hit.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you though. I agree with you. But I've never noticed it. Do you think it's ADHD meds that brings it out?
So that really, I think there's a question that you asked about that. There's not evidence about it necessarily making you more sensitive to any certain input. But I do wonder, when you've got meds, it's dampening down all of the other non-important information. And I guess in doing that, maybe it's making the questions louder in some way, because by improving your ability to focus and to get rid of some of the less important things, you can't block your kids out because they're important.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think I'm definitely more aware. But then I also got diagnosed as autistic, and that was only after being on ADHD meds. So a lot of people have sent me DMs and said, I didn't notice any of these things because I was so busy, or you know, I had so much in my brain, or I didn't notice them all. I definitely have felt exposed the last 12 months taking ADHD medication. I would hand down continue to take, and it's done wonders for me. So I'm absolutely not bagging it out. But there's the other side of it. What I have done though, a few people have said to me to treat that with a non-stimulant, and obviously we're not psychiatrists, we're not doctors, but I have noticed that since taking Intuiv, which is a non-stimulant for hyperactivity and impulsivity, which is 100% what I have, a lot of it's cognitive, but I tell you, I'm not good at sitting down either. The Intuiv has settled down some of that. I said to my husband, all I wanted for Mother's Day was to be in the dark, quiet, right? That's all I wanted. And he was like, okay, how do I make that happen? So I went to City Cave and I could not stand even the dim light. And they're like, oh, this is the blue stress light and this is yellow light for healing. And I was like, fuck these lights. So I turned them all off. I started taking medication, the Intuiv. Apparently it works within 3 or 4 days because I've already been taking Vyvanse. Then I think it was maybe a week later, 10 days later, I went back in to the same place. And I had noticed that I was feeling a bit better. But it was only after I left the sauna that I was like, wow, I left the lights on and I had music and I actually read a book and I didn't have the strong need for all of that to stop. I wasn't as affected by the sensory stuff.
Yep.
I didn't notice the lights as much. It didn't occur to me to turn everything off. I was more like...
It sounded like the second time around you were less heightened. So you weren't looking for that complete shutdown of everything. Like you could still tolerate a lot more, and maybe you could notice that without feeling an emotion attached to that. You could actually take that in as information as opposed to a threat to your nervous system.
But environment had not changed. So there was no difference at home. There was nothing changed. So the intuitive, I think, has helped with some of that. However, obviously, everyone should seek their own medical advice.
And I've definitely seen it in kids that have come in for even as autism assessments, and the ADHD traits were quite significant and they were impacting their function. The pediatrician actually said, look, we need definitely ADHD and we're not actually sure right now. When that child came back 12 months later after some OT and looking at some of those ADHD traits and being on medication, it was very clear that autistic traits of struggling to engage and some of that social reciprocity wasn't there because the hyperactive traits had dampened. So it was hard to tell whether it was previously a ADHD thing where it was just she was very impulsive. So is it just that there wasn't the attention and that's why she wasn't being able to engage in a conversation or being able to sort of show some social reciprocity? But once the ADHD was treated, then it was very clear that that was there. I've heard other adults also talk about the challenges of when you're diagnosed with ADHD and then you take medication, all of a sudden, all those things that maybe had been simmering around the surface that you could just ignore because you jumped from one thing to another and you kept busy and you just kept pushing it all down, all the noise stops and these things come up and you all of a sudden have to deal with them. And that can be really overwhelming for some people.
And I felt really ripped off too, because I was like, okay, cool. So I finally got diagnosed. I finally got the right med. I started to relax. I have to fight to get the vitamins. I was just like, this is just horrific. The fact that I'm still going with this, which is why I wasn't returning to the psychiatrist, which I should have earlier to get this sorted. Like I really left it too long. And I think if there's people listening to this that have sensory overwhelm and they are taking ADHD stimulants, I think it is important to go and seek some help because I left mine too long. And I think that has contributed to, I suppose, some of the feelings of I've just been feeling a bit down. Oh, this is just so hard. And I was expecting it to feel easier. I think there's a little bit of goodness to ADHD. And look, again, I would take ADHD medication over not taking it, but there's an element of like grief where you're like, oh, I do remember doing some pretty crazy, funny things and having a good time and not worrying about it. I do miss some of those adventures that I didn't even think about doing. Sometimes that freedom of, yeah, let's go do it. I miss those days a little bit at times because I didn't have a lot of these stuff that I'm left with now.
I think it's been really helpful to talk to you about this and about what was it that you really loved about it. Yes, maybe it's not just the impulsiveness, but was it actually, what were the experiences that you really loved? And in some ways, managing the ADHD means that you have got the ability to do a little bit more of that forethinking, understanding what you need, understanding what absolutely lights you up, understanding what doesn't work for you, what you want lots of, what you don't want any of, what you need a little bit of, what tends to make you feel a bit icky. Knowing that for you and then knowing that for your children is going to make it so much easier to think about what you want more of in your day and what you want less in your day. And we want more of the things that regulate us and less of the things that don't. We often call it a sensory diet, and that's basically filling our day, like scheduling our day in the same way we would schedule our meals, is that we have some big meals of sensory input that we love. So for those kids that love a bit of rough and tumble and lots of heavy work, are they doing wheelbarrow walks on the way to brush their teeth? Or are we out on the trampoline before breakfast or before school because that's what they need? As an adult, is it you would like to just get up and have a cup of tea before anybody else woke up? Do you just want that little bit of quiet time? Can you build that in on those days where you've dropped the kids off and I know you're so time poor? Is there one day where you can go, I'm just going to go home, have a cup of tea, I'm going to set the timer up and I'm going to sit outside for 5 minutes before I do anything else and put any other demands, and that is going to be my break, then face this next lot of stimulation and task and demands that I've got? And when your husband says, what do you want to do? I'm going to give you an hour. Really think about what is regulating for you. Is it driving somewhere that you can then go for a walk without bumping into anybody?
Yeah, it's a great point. Like when you're not feeling good, I think I've probably just had in despair a little bit. If I'm honest, like I probably haven't done enough to truly problem solve and help myself because I think I've just been caught just overwhelmed, but then not even problem solving it? You know how you just get caught. What would be some strategies that you think most people could do?
I think first it's, like I said, understanding what are your triggers probably are the most important things. So what are the things that are going to tip you over the edge and avoiding them, thinking about those things that you really love and making sure you're putting more of them into your day. Generally, from a sensory perspective, proprioceptive input, deep pressure and linear vestibular movement, up and down movement or forward and backwards, so the same plane, we call them universal modulators. So generally, they're the things that are going to help you feel calm. Gardening, swimming, walking, running. If you're feeling more down, you probably need to be going with that more gentle stuff. And if you're feeling hyped, you probably need more intensity. If you are a family that can walk your kids to school, and that's a really good way of starting your day, then put that into your day. Just think about what you can put into your everyday routine that's going to help everybody and that's going to meet the routine. So try to put it into things that you're already doing it, because it's going to make it a lot easier. And it also takes away the mental load of having to make another decision and have to problem solve it, whether it's journaling it out, whether it's talking to a friend, just finding out the things that you love and just trying to put more of that in your day. That's going to really help you. But think about when your body feels good. Like, moving is really important. Heavy work in like that pushing, pulling, carrying things, getting in the garden, housework even, if it's the vacuuming that is actually what kind of makes you feel better in your body, do that first. That's going to make you more regulated. Choose your battles and have an exit strategy. Doing things with your kids that they want to do, if you feel like you can, know how to get out of that. I'm imagining that you're tolerance for that light, tactile, icky touch is very low and theirs is very high, which means that you're probably not wanting to give them lots of experiences because that's uncomfortable to you, but they are going to find it somehow. If you can have that outside and you're like, they're going to come inside. So I'm going to have a bucket of water and two towels at the door and I can just deal with that tomorrow. If you have got that to stop it all coming into the house, just try to be a step ahead of it is the rudest thing you can say to an ADHD mum, because I could never be a step ahead of it. That's the problem. That's why we're here, trying to think about what's next while you're out there. Don't start a new thing because they're going to lose interest in a minute, but just be ready for what comes next. So try to find ways where you can let your kids meet their sensory needs in a way that doesn't completely ruin you and yours.
Yeah.
I would absolutely say if you can see an OT, because I work with children, and the one thing that I wish I did more of and that I'm trying to make more time of, which is why I even reached out to you, is stopping and thinking about what are the parents' sensory preferences, because I can give you a list of all of these things that I'd encourage you to do to support your child. But if that is in complete disharmony with what you would like to do, you're not going to want to do that. And you're just going to think, oh, well, what? She's making my life harder, not easier. And this is supposed to make it easier. So think about where your preferences and your kids intersect. Spend more time there because you're going to be enjoying that more. Mm-hmm. You're going to be getting those quality connections. They're not going to be coming looking for you later and trying to get that attention and make that connection with you when you're really overloaded. Put the oxygen mask on first. Don't think, oh, you know what, and this is something that I did as a parent, especially when they were younger, I was overloaded. I was very close to burnout. I'm like, but they need sensory experiences and they need this. So I have to set up some painting, and I'm just giving myself more and more jobs because I thought that's what a good parent looked like. And actually that's not helpful, because then I end up being snappy and then I feel bad about it. And then they're crying and then they need me, where actually I just need them to get off me. But the more you don't want them to do that, the more they're on you. So just be realistic about what you can offer in that moment. And if at that time, the kindest thing you can do to everyone is say, headphones on, we're all having our individual screen time, because that's going to regulate us, then do that. But also know that they will need to move because they've just had this downtime. Once you're ready, rather than go, all right, screens off now, we're going to do something that you hate. Let's go screens off. We're already, we're going outside to jump on the trampoline, or we're going outside to swing, or we're going outside to have a handstand competition, or whatever it is that is going to pique their interest, and use that to support your transitions. Because transitions are really challenging with neurodivergent kids and adults.
The transitions, it's not even about being
there. It's a whole nother podcast.
Getting there And then it's like leaving. My hubby said to me the other day something, he had to go somewhere. And I was like, I just need you to help me leave netball or leave soccer. I was like, you don't even have to watch the game. Can you just be there between 10:20 and 10:40? He's like, you want me to drive 20 minutes to be there for 20 minutes? I was like, yes, because otherwise it would take me 90 minutes. If you could just arrive for the 20 minutes of leaving, that would be great. Like, I'll never make it.
And I love that you're able to identify that is actually the place where you need the most help and asking for help. And that is really helpful once you realize what it is that you need.
You're like, yeah, why was that such a head fuck? What's the leaving part that gets me? This has been so helpful. I feel like I could just go with you for another hour, but we will have to pull it up there at some point. We might have to do transitions possibly another time.
I feel like that's a whole nother podcast.
That is a whole nother podcast completely, because doesn't everybody talk about the transitions? And transitioning is just, because I've got one that like wants to leave as soon as we arrive and one that never wants to leave. And so as soon as you got differences, like you spoke about it, it's just a complete mess.
Yep.
Thank you so much. There's been lots for me to think about. And I think biggest take home message for me and probably other people listening is put yourself first a little more, because I think I've been not doing that. Yeah.
And know your preferences. Just get to know what's underneath as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we probably don't do that enough. And anyone listening to this podcast that's questioning, am I doing it right? Am I enough? The mum guilt. I think as soon as you feel mum guilt that you are doing a really good job, because you're worrying about it enough to listen to a podcast about how to be better, the fact that you're listening and trying so hard and then questioning and then laying awake at night worrying, that's the sign of a good mother that cares. But look, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it.
Thanks for having me.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums Podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.